The word socialism has made its way into our politics a lot recently. Last week, Vice President Mike Pence derided Democratic health plans as socialist. And over the weekend, President Trump used the word repeatedly to condemn Democratic policies.
Democrat lawmakers are now embracing socialism. They want to replace individual rights with total government domination.
So how did the word socialism become a scare tactic in American politics? Joining us to look at the history are historians Nathan Connolly and Ed Ayers, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Hi, guys.
Hey.
Thanks.
So if you look up socialism in the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, one of the definitions is socialism is a system or society in which there is no private property and, quote, the means of production are controlled by the state. Nathan, that does not sound like the American system that we know today.
I think many people would assume that socialism is very un-American, but there also are very different stripes of it. In the European strain, there was a great emphasis on to each according to their need, from each according to their skill. On the American side, you have a certain commitment to maybe a revolutionary rhetoric, but reformist implementation for the most part. And the other thing that may surprise people is that just day-to-day practices that we would today call socialistic, perhaps, certainly publicly owned lands represent a kind of socialism, whether you're talking about parks or grazing land, and even something like, say, eminent domain, which is the taking of private property for a public good, is actually a very American practice, moving something from a market to a non-market use, per se.
Ed, do you agree with that socialism is part of the American story?
Yeah, and I would also maybe expand our understanding of a little bit to think about the Shakers, for example, who seem so American and unthreatening, believed in socialism.
And remind us who the Shakers were, by the way.
Well, the Shakers, a religious sect that believed that in simplicity, and people think of Shaker furniture, kind of embodies nothing wasted, everything shared. They were called Shakers because, like Quakers, their enemies made fun of the way that when they were possessed by the spirit, they would shake or quake. So, today you can visit their communal home place in New England and it looks so pretty and nice, but it's socialism too. So I think as Nathan is suggesting, we need to remember there's lots of different varieties of this.
And when did socialism start to become a dirty word?
Well, before it really became a dirty word, it became a very popular word. The second best-selling book of the 19th century was Edward Bellamy's Looking Backward, which actually is a utopian vision of what America might be in the future. And there were utopian Bellamy clubs all across the United States. And so that's in 1888. That recently, in the middle of the Gilded Age, which had the great wealth disparities that we're seeing today. Some people talk about living the second Gilded Age. Well, that was the first one when people were so shocked about what concentration of wealth meant and what corporate power meant. People immediately started imagining what an alternative might be. And one of the men who came out of that culture was Eugene V. Debs from Terre Haute, Indiana, who became the great socialist of American history. And I guess to answer your question, it was around Debs that socialism began to become a dirty word.
So Debs is a figure that is, by many accounts considered the most important American socialist of all time. But there's a broad base to the socialist movement in the late 19th and early 20th century, so much so, in fact, that you have entire government organizations that are built to basically police and try to drum socialists out of American society. What we might call the first Red Scare in the 19-teens and 20s was an effort to basically treat socialists as if they were the same as anarchists, as if they were the same as just general, terrorists. And you have a man, an attorney general by the name of A. Mitchell Palmer, who takes it upon himself to basically create an entire radical division of the Justice Department, populated in the early going by a young J. Edgar Hoover, to begin to crack down on those who espouse what they believe to be socialist ideas.
And they felt they had to do that because the socialists sort of peaked in 1912, right before World War I. Debs got 6% of the vote, which is 900,000 people voting for somebody calling himself a socialist.
Now, you mentioned, Ed, that the word socialism took on an important meaning during the Gilded Age. What about during the Great Depression? How did people view socialism when things weren't so good?
Yeah, you know, so socialism sort of fades away. Debs is put into prison for opposing World War I. He stays there until 1921 when he has deteriorating health. And so you don't hear much about it. You know, we picture the 20s and the flappers and all the prosperity and so forth. But then, of course, all that comes crashing down in the Great Depression. And people begin to suspect that Roosevelt is really a socialist. And that even though he's doing great things like creating Social Security Administration, or maybe because he's doing great things like creating the Social Security Administration, people begin to really believe that he's taking America in a direction that's too close to that being followed by Russia.
And what about after the Great Depression? Or how did the idea of socialism evolve in the last 100 years or so?
So during the Depression, you obviously have the federal government stepping into a host of sectors to try to salvage the American economy. So they're stepping into agriculture, they're stepping into housing. And in many of those sectors where you have private capital trying to make its money, they'll use pejoratives like creeping socialism to describe anything the government is doing. So landlords, for example, hated public housing and talked about it as being creeping socialism. And that was a debate that raged through the mid-20th century around whether or not there would be, you know, robust public housing projects around different corners of urban America. At the same time, you have people like A. Philip Randolph, who is a black labor organizer, who's advancing a cause of civil rights, arguing that basically, you know, capitalism creates divisions between white and black workers. And so a socialist position would create greater racial equality. And Randolph himself, who lived very long, you know, brought this impulse of trying to balance a socialist position, in effect, into the 1960s with the March on Washington in 1963, which we don't tend to think about as a grand socialist protest. But if you look at the actual principles of the manifesto, they're very clear. And they say that integration in the fields of transportation, public accommodation, education, and housing will be of limited extent and duration so long as fundamental economic inequality along racial lines persists. And it's that connection between economic and racial inequality that many socialists of color tried to carry into the late 70s and beyond.
Okay. And that brings us to the Cold War. And of course, we have to talk about McCarthyism. Ed, that must have shaped the definition of socialism in America in a big way.
Well, it did. You know, so a lot of the criticism of the civil rights movement that Nathan was just talking about is these people who are leading it are commies, right? If you want to discredit anybody. Mm-hmm. And of course, McCarthy coming out in the early 1950s claiming to have found communists embedded throughout the government,
right,
a kind of deep state, if you will, became the great cause in which people, this creeping socialism that Nathan talked about, it didn't seem to be creeping anymore. It seemed to really be kind of taking over the federal government in the vision of McCarthyites.
And after that, you know, you wouldn't even think that it would be possible for somebody to run with the word socialism in their party name and do well. But then here we are now, and socialism is back. And you've got people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Democratic Socialist, Bernie Sanders, did so well in the last election, is now kind of the front runner among the Democrats who are running at the moment, also Democratic Socialist. What happened?
So, I mean, through the 1970s and 80s, most mainstream politicians would flee from the very notion that they could be associated with socialism, right? Folks on the new left, you know, basically were demobilized. And you have someone like Ronald Reagan, who certainly was able to fan a vision of Americanism that placed socialism on the outside of it. You think about the Democratic Party through the 1990s under Bill Clinton, and even now in the early 20th century, you know, they weren't really trying to take up the mantle of socialism. What's so remarkable is that many of the same principles that guided someone like A. Philip Randolph or Martin Luther King even, who defined himself as a democratic socialist, were part of this attempt to again think about the Americanness of the institution, going all the way back to someone like Debs and saying, look, if our job as democratic socialists is to make sure that capitalism's excesses don't crush the working class or don't make it possible to prey on, you know, poor people, then we're basically being good Americans. And so there's an effort now to try to collapse, as what happened in the 19th century, the relationship between being a good American and basically being conversant in some of the key principles of socialist reform.
Ed Ayers and Nathan Connolly, co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And again, Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are Democratic Socialists. That party says it believes that both the economy and society should be run democratically to meet public needs, not to make profits for a few.